Right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope to speak to you tonight about the subject of the Logos in biology. Now, there are a lot of you here who are at school or are teaching school and teach biology. And what I want to show you tonight is how much positive evidence there is that the Logos is behind it all. And I'm going to give you some examples which you might be able to use to help your children and maybe help yourself at the same time. Now, there are at the back a number of books on these subjects, because I can't go into all the chemistry of this tonight, because you'd fall down dead if I did. But I'll give you the principles, and then when you've got a spare moment, you can go and fill in all the details from the little books, book of words, at the back there on the chemistry and on the information theory behind all that I say tonight. So let's just read one word of God for our subject tonight, and it's this. Listen to it very carefully. Who knows the interpretation of a thing? Now, we're going to talk about a thing, but the thing we're going to talk about tonight is biology. Who knows the interpretation of a thing? And I'm going to try and do some interpretation of facts which some of you know about already, but perhaps haven't thought of the interpretation. Then it says, a man's wisdom in interpretation of things, a man's wisdom makes his face to shine. I like that one. A man's wisdom, it includes the ladies as well, although they sometimes don't like their faces to shine, you know. They put powder on to stop that, don't they? But I think it's a good thing if a man's face shines. And it says, a man's wisdom makes his face to shine, and the hardness of his countenance is changed. That is, the hardness of a man or a woman's countenance is changed by knowing the interpretation of things. So that's what we want to do. Now, Solomon did that, didn't he? He talked about everything, from the little plants on the wall to the large animals of the sea. He talked about them. And he was the most wise man on earth at the time. Now, the subject then is Logos, the Logos, in biology today. And I want to have a look at the basis of all biology, which is the cell. The simple cell, there aren't any things as simple cells, but that's what they say. The cell is a metabolic unit which extracts, don't be afraid and don't take flight before I finish, which extracts energy from its environment for its own purposes, particularly for replication, particularly for growth, and particularly for survival. So that's the single cell. Now, we're all made up of millions of cells, but the only way we can function as human beings is if each cell gives up its own life in the interests of the whole body. You see, my nerve cells, the millions of them in the brain, there are one or two just there, you know, the millions of them in the brain, if they were to all have their original freedom, which they did have at one time as amoeba-like cells, you'd never be able to transmit a thought. So they give up their own personal freedom in order to make a greater intelligent whole. The cells of the liver give up their original freedom so that they can function as a liver and digest my food and all the rest of it. My eyes do the same. They've given up their personal free life in order that the whole may see. So that is what the function of a cell is. Now, you find the exact picture of that in the church. The church is the body of Christ and consists of people who have dedicated themselves to the whole body, which is the church, and which is the Christ, according to the Holy Scriptures. So in that we do collaborate with one another rather than serve ourselves, that makes possible a greater intelligence and effectiveness than would otherwise be possible. That's the meaning of the cell from the church point of view. Now, I don't want to talk about that tonight, but it's one little thing that I just couldn't let go by because it's so important. Now, what is a cell? Now, listen ever so carefully to this because you'll be rather shocked, perhaps. A cell is really a bundle of keys. Keys, K-E-Y-S. You see, in the food that we eat, and after all, I am physically what I eat, so are you. In the food that we eat, there is energy. And I need the energy for my own purposes and for the purposes of the cells of the whole body. Now, I put on the board there. I'm not much of a Picasso, but I've done my best. There's a little cube there I put on the board, and there's a little hole in the front, which is a keyhole. And I have projected inside the keyhole sort of an author's impression of a lock. Now, you see, I put a lot of profiles on there so that you can see that's a safe, a safe. And in the safe, I've got another little block there labeled AU. Now, for all the elite and intelligentsia of Calvary Chapel, AU means aurum or gold. So what you put in safes, among other things, is gold, isn't it? Now, we have a safe, then, full of gold, and it's nicely locked up, to be sure. What are the ways of getting the gold out of the safe? Well, now, I'll suggest you two ways, and we'll choose the method we want to use for later purposes. You can either take, as I put there in the top corner, in the bottom corner there, you can either take an oxyacetylene blowtorch, you know, with a cylinder of oxygen and a cylinder of acetylene there and a nice little torch to get 2,000 or 3,000 degrees centigrade, and you can burn the lock out. Now, that's one way of doing it. Lots of people try it. I don't advise it because you ruin your safe, and if the police see you doing it, their suspicions will be aroused. That's one way of doing it. Now, the other way of doing it is, of course, to find the key. If you can find the key, it's easy. You just insert it, and you turn it, and the door opens, and out falls your gold. So it's dead easy, but the thing is to find the key. Now, food, all the food we eat, is like a safe, or many kinds of safe. And in the safe, the food we eat, there are calories instead of gold, and we need the calories to live on. Now, if you want to get the calories out of food, there are two ways of doing it, just as there are two ways of getting to a safe. You can burn it, like I do when I try and cook the dinner for my wife, you see, and it falls on the hot plate, and the place is full of the stink of burnt food, you see, and burnt soup, and my wife will come and ask, have you done it again, you see? So you say you have. It's a very inelegant way of getting the calories out of food. Mind you, you can burn food, but it's not considered the way to do it. Now, with regard to the cell needs that gold or those calories in the molecules of food that we eat. And the molecules of food that we eat are like little safes. And in those safes, there's the gold or the calories stored. Now, the cell doesn't go about it in a bullheaded manner. It doesn't burn the food with an open flame. Only the dragons of old, you know, with the fire coming out of their noses, they apparently did it that way, although I'm not quite sure that that's an authentic scientific fact. But I doubt very much, because the proteins wouldn't stand for the heat, would they, and for the smoke. Anyway, the other way of getting it out is to find the key. Now, the remarkable thing is that every cell is a bundle of keys. Some of them are master keys. And they'll fit all the safes which hold the calories in our food and unlock it without the slightest difficulty. They just fiddle around the food, sniff around it, and they'll have the key ready in 1 minute and insert it, and the calories will fall out just as elegant as you like. Just a wonderful method. Now, listen, let me hear those cogwheels whirring up top, because otherwise you will not get this bit of chemistry, and this is rather hard to get across, but it's vital. Do you think the elite and the prestigious denizens of Calvary Chapel here in Los Angeles, Costa Mesa and Santa Ana, whatever you call the place here, I've never found out whether it's Santa Ana or Costa Mesa, but never mind, that's beside the point. What I'm getting at is, you, the elite, and the instructees of our worthy pastor here, have you ever thought what makes a key and a lock function? If you haven't, I'll have you certified. But if you have, consider this. This is vital for all the teachers of biology that are here. If you have, do you think that the properties of the metal of which the key and lock are made, that they provide the profile on the key that makes it fit? That is, do you think that if you could get the properties of the bronze nicely classified that made the key, do you think that they could be related to the profile on the key that makes it work? You see, you know when you copy a key, don't you, that the profile has to be copied exactly. You put it into the copying apparatus and it follows exactly the key that you want to copy, and it puts it onto the new piece of bronze or steel, or even plastic today, for making the lock. Now, what I want to get over to you is to be perfectly plain on this point, that the profile of a key is not related to the properties of the metal of which the key is made. It'll hold those properties, it'll hold the profile if it's stiff enough, and to make a key it's got to be stiff enough. But once you've got it stiff enough, you can take plastic, you can take anything you like, you can take lead or silver as long as it's hard enough, and put the profile on it. But the profile does not originate in the metal or in the plastic. It's put on there from outside. Now, the body and the cells, even the so-called simple cells, have at very least, 2,000 lock and key mechanisms in them to open the food in the environment round about them. At least a bundle of 2,000 keys to fit the locks of the food in nature. The remarkable thing is, the profiles of the keys in nature, they are called enzymes, and are a subject of my first dissertation I ever wrote. They are called enzymes, and they're absolutely able, by their shape, which chemistry alone cannot produce. That's definite. They alone can open all the kinds of food there is hanging around for us to eat. And they do so. Some of the keys are master keys, and they'll open 2 or 3 kinds of safes. Others are very specific and will only open 1 kind of safe, but safes they will open. Now that's the first thing. The second thing to note is this, friends, it's a marvelous thought if you give it a little bit of consideration. How does the cell know in its DNA programming the kind of locks it's going to have to open? It does know, because I say no in inverted commas, because on the DNA molecule, there is written up the exact profiles of every key and every master key in that cell, which will feel and scan the food that's put near the cell and will open it and get out the calories so that they can live, get out the energy so that they can live. How does it know? Because, you know, there's one thing that's absolutely certain, ladies and gentlemen, that you don't make a key and a lock mechanism by random processes. And Darwin says the whole bag of tricks is made by random processes over millions of years. Now, did you ever see a locksmith go at making a fine, exact lock and key mechanism by that sort of process? You'd have him certified on the spot if he tried to do it like that. And that's what all our kids are asked to believe at school. I think it's an absolute scandal to invert their common sense by telling them these things. It's time that we told them the truth, that the one who made the food must have been the one who made the DNA molecule of the cell to give the cell the instructions, what profile it needed to open the food. Because the two hadn't got any contact with one another until the food comes to be digested, and the cell comes to get some food. And yet the cell knows exactly the thousands of types of keys. They're absolutely perfect fits made by what is called optical activity in the cells. If you want to read that, ladies and gentlemen, you can read it in the Natural Sciences Know Nothing of Evolution. I gave that to my publisher in Switzerland, 8 years ago, and I said, you know, you have as a coat of arms for your firm, which was formed at the time of Gutenberg, who invented printing. You remember the little story, don't you? He has a coat of arms for Schwab and Company, which is my publisher in Switzerland, an anvil and a hammer. And out of the anvil and the hammer, huge sparks coming in every direction. So I said, if you publish this book, you will realize in practice what your coat of arms says. Whoo, he said, that's just what we want to do. Well, I said, I don't know whether you've got courage enough to do it, but that's what'll happen. He said, well, if it's good science, we'll take it. I said, be sure, careful what you do, because you may get into trouble. Well, I said, you've got a fortnight to consider it. That's 2 weeks to you people, to consider it. And he said, you don't mean to say, do you, Professor, that we've got to publish the book in 2 weeks, do you? No, I said, I'm not mad, you know. You can think about it for 2 weeks and then tell me. He telephoned in 1 week and said, we'll take it, it's good science. And that's what I said in the book. Read it, it's in the Natural Sciences Know Nothing of Evolution. That the keys given to the cell, the profiles of those keys, are fixed up, laid down on the DNA molecule of the cell, and they know the type of locks there are on food, and will open them. Now, there are several types of keys and locks, and I don't want to go into them in detail. But one's an ester. For chemists here, you'll know what that means. Another is a double bond. Another is a carbohydrate. Another's a fat. And there are special keys and locks for all these systems. And the cell's got it off pat, can open them immediately and get the calories out. Well, now, when you think of a key and a lock mechanism, I would say myself that the simplest and the most sensible way of explaining that is to say that there was a locksmith. The same as who knew his job. The same as there is, you see, for a clock, a watchmaker, or for a watch, a watchmaker. I think that's fairly obvious, and it brings back to that question we did last week, you know, about design needing a designer. Now, if you try and get around that, as Darwin did, you can't get around it today with the knowledge that we've gained since Darwin died. And part of the knowledge is how to make the shape right, and the shape is to do with the optical activity for those who've done their chemistry, but I can't explain that tonight. Now, that's the first thing. And every cell knows how to do it. No cell could live if it didn't make those locks and keys first to get the energy it needs out of the food which is round about it. Now, keep that firmly in your mind, and you can draw a little red line under what I've said, because I'm going to give a second example now, and at the end I'm going to tie it all up together, and I hope that you'll worship God when you see it, because it's marvelous when you think of how the cell works. There you can see the logos in it. So draw a little red line under what I've said, and we come to the second example now. Now, there's a more remarkable lock and key mechanism in the body which concerns us as human beings very particularly. It's like this. We're not going to talk now about food molecules having calories in them, but we're going to talk about languages and books having contents in them. Now, this book here, which was given me in Wheaton 25 years ago when we left Wheaton in Illinois, this book is a safe. And in it, lots and lots of sequences, bits of information, which are coded according to the English language. Now, when I read that, you know, I was brought up to understand the English language, as you might guess. And there's one thing, if you give this book to a Turk, we lived 2 years in Turkey, you know, he looks at it, and he look ever so wise, because the Turks can do that, he look ever so wise, and he say, "Don't mean anything to me." Why not? Because the dear good fellow hasn't got the key to open it. He wasn't taught at school. And the key to open it is, of course, the English grammar, and the English vocabulary. And if you learn the English grammar and the English vocabulary, you can very soon unlock this safe and get out all the information which is hidden in it. But you can't take an oxyacetylene torch and get out that information. There's no way of doing it. You must have the key to do it. There's no easy way around it and no hard way around it. You've got to do it the right way. Now, I say the easy way and the hard way. Have you ever thought, ladies and gentlemen, once when I was busy learning Russian, because I had to do Russian when during the war, we had gallant allies there, you know, and they came and looked round our laboratories to see what we were up to. And they couldn't find anybody to talk to these people. So they thought, well, here's the fellow, teach him Russian. So there I was, led off to a nice Russian boy twice a week, and I was sitting down one day learning my Russian grammar. Oh, boys, Russian grammar, it makes me great to think of it. Anyway, while I was doing this, our microanalyst, who was a Christian, a very nice little man, and he was his flink, he was his fleet of foot, and elegant in his language, as a microanalyst should be. He came, touched me on the shoulder, and he said, "Wilder, you look as though you're in rough sea at that job." So I said, "Well, I am. I not only look like it, but I am." And he said, "Do you know this? That even the babies in Russian can read that. They don't have to work at it. You must be dumber than the babies in Russian." So I said to him, "Heron," his name was Heron, I said, "That's very nice of you to tell me that. It's a bit tactless, isn't it, under the circumstances?" So he said it was truth. So I said, "Truth isn't always tactful, you know." And but have you thought about it? If you confront a baby with a language, the baby can decode it. It takes time. Have you ever watched a mother talking to a baby? We've had four, and they've had to learn a number of languages very, 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 very early. So let's have a look at how a baby learns a language. A baby hasn't got much vocabulary, but it's got eyes, and it has ears and the mouth. Now, if you put the baby, after it's learned to focus its eyes, you know when they're born, they can't focus their eyes. One eye looks up here and the other eye looks down there, and poor little thing's lost. But after a time, they get their eyes parallel and can look at you. And when that great event comes, the first smile that it gives its mother, now, that's a great event. The first smile of recognition of the mother. You've seen that, haven't you? It's really wonderful. A little child looks at its mother, and you can see the sheer joy as it smiles. Now, you do this little experiment with the baby. As soon as it can focus its eyes, I'm not going to do a bad experiment. This is a good one. You prop it up on the bed in pillows so that it's more or less sitting up as straight as it can. And then you put the mother at the foot of the bed, and she talks to the babe. You know what mothers say. I'm not very good at this, but I'll do my best. Here they say honey, don't they? Well, if a woman says honey, it's an American, sure enough. But an English woman will say darling or something like that, or sweetie pie is what they call them in England. And she'll sit there and say sweetie pie, you see, and darling and all the rest of it. And the babe will look and listen very, very intently. And then it'll form its lips and it'll try to say weedie pie. It will. And that's the way it learns. Now listen, this is the experiment. You now put between mother and baby a big Perspex glass transparent sheet, screen. You know, a nice transparent one, perfectly transparent. And the mother is now asked to speak into two microphones. And one loudspeaker from each microphone is on each side of the bed. So you've got two lateral microphones, and the speakers and the microphones up with the mother, separated by this large screen between the mother and the babe. Now, they let the two microphones work, speaker on both sides of the bed, and the babe will continue trying to imitate its mother and will crow with ecstasy, you know, when it finds it's got the mother's attention. But now you do something which is very wicked. You turn off one of the microphones so that the baby sees the mother's lips working but will hear the mother's voice at the side of the bed. Now it's used to seeing where the sound comes from. And the computer is built up to work on that. It'll see what it hears. And that gives it two directions on which to work on the language. The two directions, much better than one. So it goes at it from two sides. Now you turn one off, the baby will immediately howl. It can't deal with that. It's too hard. And it'll cry miserably because the voice is not coming from where it knows it is coming from, namely from the mouth. And it can't work on that basis. Now, as soon as you turn the loudspeakers back again so that it hears the voice from where it sees the lips moving, it'll crow with delight again and the seance will go just nicely again. You see, the computer is set up to take from two directions, from the hearing and from the seeing, to decode any language. Now, how does it do that? Well, now, you think of a computer that will decode a language by just looking and hearing. You try and build a computer to decode Russian into English by that method and see where you get. Noam Chomsky filled the university, the MIT, with super-duper hypercomputers to do that. Uncle Sam wanted a machine in which you could feed in the secret Russian documents they'd stolen from somebody or another, you see, in Russian. And they wanted to feed those into the machine and the English edition should come out the other end. Lovely idea. But after he'd spent millions on this, he sent in his resignation and said, this can't be done, it's a waste of taxpayers' money. It's too complex. the programming to do that, to see and hear and decode, open the closed safe with all the information in it, in the language, is too complex. Now, he was asked to explain why he couldn't do it, so he did. He said, look here, the only explanation of language, to find this in a scientific textbook, it's called Language and Mind by Noam Chomsky, to find the explanation given in that book gives you as a Christian an absolute jolt. He said, how does a baby do it? The baby must have something to bite on, to latch on to do it. How does he do it? Well, he said, there's all the evidence that we can find in analyzing the various languages that are extant on the earth today. There's all the evidence that once upon a time, all language was one on earth. We had a complex, complete language, and every man spoke the same language. Now, he said, at the Tower of Babel, and to find that written in a scientific textbook, you know, there's no Wellhausen critique of the Bible in that. He said, at the Tower of Babel, that one language was scrambled. Now, you all know what scramble means, don't you? Was just simply mixed up, like a scrambler does on the radio, so that you can't hear the language, and you have to descramble it to get it back again. He said it was scrambled, but in the scrambling process, for all the languages that have been produced, the common factor for all languages remained hidden in those scrambled languages. So there is common to all languages a factor which they call P, which they haven't yet identified. But they know it to be there, otherwise a baby wouldn't be able to decode any language you care to present it with. Couldn't do it. From a theoretical point of view, from the computer point of view, it must have something to latch on to, a common factor. Well, if you get this common factor, then the baby cottons onto that and will gradually uncode the language through that common factor. Now you think, every baby is genetically programmed to build a computer that will just hear and see a spoken language, and in 2 or 3 years, it'll speak that language that it's learned that way. Now, you try and do that. That's what we're trying to do with computers. And it's an insuperable problem today. Now you think of the other thing, that programming of the baby's computer to build the software and hardware of a computer like that was present on one sperm, the size of a pinpoint, and one egg, the size of a pinhead. And all the information was there, besides the information to build the baby's eyes, to build the baby's ears, to build the baby's heart, to build the baby's lungs, to build the baby's legs, to build his kidneys, to build everything that he is, and also to build the genetic cells for the future generations as long as the human race exists. And all computerized and miniaturized on one sperm and one egg. Now you think of the intelligence required to do that. If you tell me that programming of that sort was made by random processes from natural law, well, there would be common ways of saying what I do with you, but the real way to do it would have you certified immediately and put out of danger to the public, you see, if you're going to do that. I mean, it's simply incredible where we've got to with all the information we have. So, that's as far as I want to go on that point. The important thing is that the baby's computer is able to do that. Now, if you wait 10 or 15 years until puberty, you present then the young man or the young woman with the decoding of a language, and you ask him to learn German, or you ask him to learn Russian, when he's got four children of his own, you know, and the poor fellow can't do it. Because he's given, for a few years, a plastic computer which is capable of scanning out any language to extract the meaning from it. That is, he's given a key which will be inserted into it. It is capable of being inserted into any language and opening it. That is, giving the code for it. But after he's got, say, 15, 20 years old, the crust grows over the key and it doesn't fit. He works and works and works at it, but he always speaks with an accent, you know. You can't get round it. The thing is this, we're always given just time enough to do what needs to be done. And a child needs to learn by the time it's 14 or 15, perfectly, the language that it needs for its life. And after that, the plasticity of the computer sets, and it can't take in any more new profiles for keys or languages unless it's learnt two or three when it's young. I found this, that I didn't stop learning languages, my wife, until we got four children. And so we weren't then exactly what you might say teenagers. But because we'd learnt one or two languages early, you see, we had to learn French. We lived in French Switzerland. And we had to know German because we went then to German Switzerland, and we've been always round where they speak all sorts of outlandish languages like English, and we've had to learn all these things. Now, the trouble with the education system here is not only that they're teaching you wrong things about biology. The trouble is they're teaching them too late. You find American boys and girls on the mission field, devoted people. And they start to learn the language when they're about 28 or 30. And you know, it's far too late. They could have done it when they were 6, 8 years old. But now that the profile has got set and is no longer plastic, it can't feel its way into the language as a baby can. The thing is this, it's too late and too little. That's the trouble. Now, if you go to Russia, I haven't any shares in Russia or in Marxism, as you may guess. But if you go to Russia, you'll find one of the astounding things there is that if you go into the schools, the children will often address you in Shakespeare English, and perfectly. Their teachers speak English with them. And they do it by the same method as mother to child. Then they learn the grammar afterwards. That's the way to do it. That we're built like that. The information on the sperm that made us and on the egg that made us like that. And then you get not half the trouble that you normally would have. Now, perhaps you'd allow me, ladies and gentlemen, to say a little bit of our own experience, because we've moved house 26 times since we've been married, and we've had four children on the way, as it were, and it takes a little bit of doing that because of the schooling. Now, what we did, we took very great care that we spoke, when the children were going to English-speaking schools, we would not understand English in the home. Now, it takes a great deal of character, particularly on the part of the mother, to stick to that. And when the child tries to revert, you see, to the language it's using in school, not to give way and to insist. Now, the result was that our children had no difficulty when we went back to Europe, when they were all about in their teens, you see, young teens. They had no difficulties at all because they already spoke three languages. So they could concentrate on the sciences. And they all got to university by the time they were 16 or 17. Because they didn't have to sit down and sweat at a late age to get the languages, which are mandatory, you see, to get into a European university, because they'd already got them. So they could concentrate on doing the science, which was a bit harder. So think of these things. They're very important for practical wisdom in life. Now, let's just One other thing. When we lived in Wheaton in Illinois, these are little practical things that we've come across in the course of our life. There was a nice young woman there, a German lady, and she'd married a GI when he was in Germany. And they had one little daughter, about 3-4 years old. So I addressed her when I came in German, you see, as I normally would do. And the little girl came up, nice little bright little girl, so I addressed her in German. You know, she looked at me as if I'd hit her over the head with a golf club or something like that, because she was absolutely shocked. Well, now, I said to the mother, that's remarkable. Doesn't she speak any German? And she wept. She said, I'm so worried about my little child. I think she must be dumb. Now, I said, just take her, look at her eyes. Her eyes are all right. She's not dumb. She said, well, look, I take her every day for an hour to the kitchen table, and I give her a lesson in German. I said, Madam, you're one of the good old German type. You love hard work, don't you, even though it's not necessary? She looked at me as though I'd hurt her, you see. So I said, Madam, if you just talk to your child in German, she'll be all right. Never occurred to her. There she got out her textbooks and was burdening this kid with all the grammar, you know, der, die, and das, and all the rest of it that they burden kids with. They learn it far easier if you just talk to them, you know. So she was working too hard. Now, I'm not suggesting here in Calvary Chapel that you work too hard. I wouldn't say that at all. But just go the natural way, you'll be all right. So I don't know what she did. I didn't see her after that because we left shortly afterwards. But we're made such that we can learn very easy, and we can unravel any system of language or code by this method that I've told you. Now, let's just have a little bit, look at this a little bit further and see where we get to. You know what a wolf child is, don't you? Human children that are brought up with animals are called wolf children. If they haven't any contact with human beings, they don't speak. They'll just make the noises that the animals make. Now, there was in California many, many years ago, in the days when the West was wild, there was a group of Indians living in one of the Californian forests which had some young children, and the Indians had a tendency to steal. So there was a tendency on the part of the Western settlers to shoot them at sight. Well, horrible way of going on, but that's how it was done. Now, from one little village of these Indians, there was one day a group of the warriors went out to collect some eggs, you see, from the white settlers, and to collect some fowl, because they had good fowl and good eggs. And they were caught, and they were all killed. Now, the people left at home were the old people, just 2 or 3 old people, to look after the children, look after the little camp. Now, when the others didn't come back, after 2 or 3 days, the old people left 1 or 2 of the older children and the very young children in the camp, and they went out to search for those that had not come back. And they didn't come back either. The children were left in the camp, and as a result, they're pretty hardy, you know, these kids. As a result, there was only one boy which survived. He was about 2 or 3 years old, and he managed to get through. And he lived in the forest alone about 20, 25 years. And after 20, 25 years speaking to nobody and having no human contacts, he was in effect a wolf child. Now, after this long time, he became so lonely for human fellowship that he resolved he'd give himself up to the white man. So one day he prepared himself and walked into the white man's settlement, and 20 years had elapsed, and the old days of just shooting people at sight had gone, and they received him kindly, because they didn't know about the past, you see. And he was very glad to be in human company. Now, they found him work to show in a museum how the Indians made their weapons, you know, bows and arrows and all the things that they had, knives and all the rest of it. And he worked all 4 or 5 years like that, but he could never learn a language. He could string vowels and nouns together, but not grammatically, you know, like a child does sometimes. They get the tenses all wrong, if there are any tenses there, but they just string things together, just like a baby does. Now, he never learned, and of course he died of tuberculosis, as they usually do if they come from the wilderness and get the infection from the white man. But that's an example of this fact, that it isn't the degree of intelligence that you have to learn a language. It's the state of the computer at the time that the language is fed into it through the ears and through the eyes. That's what counts. Now, just keep that in mind as we think further. That also is a sign that the one who made us knew that we need to learn the language at the beginning of life, because that's when we learn from other people. So we're given a set period in which to learn the maximum amount we can of language. It reminds us of, if we look after the seconds, the days and the months and the years will look after themselves. But if you lose your youth, let the kids hang around at home, you know, from the time they can walk until the time they go to school when they're about 7, and they've lost most of the plastic period when they can get half a dozen languages without any difficulty behind them, and be able to extract the information in those various languages which they could get by, without any effort, or without much effort, and decoding the languages which come their way. It's a waste of time doing it as we do, the hard way. The best way is the natural way of doing it, such as God has prepared for us, so that we can get through life properly and as easily as possible. Now, the fitting of the code into the language, and the language into the code, and the key which we put in with our eyes and our ears to get the language out, comes automatically in the young years. The older years, you lose that faculty. The younger years are all right. Now, you think what that means, ladies and gentlemen. To get the information out of language, you want to read Noam Chomsky's Language and Mind to see the problem involved, and the problem that even a baby is capable of solving because of the information that God has put it into its DNA molecule to extract the meaning of any code with which you care to present it. You can get mechanical translation. We can do that with a machine and with a computer, but you can't get a machine to do it like a human brain does. You get, for example, somebody trying to get a machine to translate, the bullet missed him by the skin of his teeth. Now, you ask a computer to translate that, and it'll translate all sorts of things from Russian of skin on the teeth, and the Russians say, well, this teeth don't have any skin. You see, they don't realize that it's most difficult to get idiomatic language translated. You can't do it that way. It's the holistic method of extracting the information from a language which is important. But you think the babe has no difficulty about that. As soon as it gets old and able to use the simple language, it'll go on to the idiomatic language. You think of saying, when the cows come home, you know, the English farmer who doesn't want to do a job immediately will say, well, when the cows come home. Now, you translate that into Russian, and you'll find the Russian will be looking at you very skeptically to
to see if you're really all there when the cows come home. But we know what it means. It's an idiomatic way of expressing things. Now, the baby computer can do all that, and it's all built into one computer up here from the hardware on one sperm and one ovum. Now you think just what that means. Now that's the second example I wanted to give you, how to open a language with the keys that we have. Now you have, not very far from here, they tell me, the newspapers tell me, that you have what's called a stealth bomber, don't you? Quite a nice little fellow, I understand. Pity it's used for such purposes, isn't it? But you see, it's such a super-duper piece of technique that no man can fly it. It has to be done by computer. And there are a number of computers which are quick enough to keep that machine in the air. That is, it's totally computerized in order to be used. And therefore is rightly touted as one of the triumphs of modern technique. Now, if the computer goes wrong, there's no way of saving it. It's out of the air before you can say Jack Robinson. Now, but you think now just one little bit further. The Americans wanted years ago, not so many years ago, they wanted a better way of conducting a tank over rough terrain, rough ground. And they thought wheels aren't very good. And tracks, well, they get stuck too, don't they? Tank tracks. And if you run tanks on tracks along the freeway, the county council gets rather upset about it, doesn't it? Because it rips up every bit of road that you've put down so nicely, these heavy tracks. So they said, we want to do it better. Now I think this all comes out to one thing. I'm going to put the ends together in just one second. They said, we want a better method of contact with the ground. The best method would be a tank on two legs, like we are. We can get over the roughest of ground, on two legs, and without tearing up the roads. So they said, we'll make a tank, but to try it out, we'll do it on four legs. So, it's easier on four than two, but they built a tank with four legs, somewhat like an alligator, and it was so clumsy and slow that it had been shot to pieces before it had shown its face on the battlefield. So they said, well, okay, we'll have to do it on two legs, because, four legs going along like this. You've seen the seals, haven't you, at the Sea World down in San Diego, how they go along on their flippers. It's handy, but I doubt whether it's ideal for running races. Anyway, they built these machines on four legs and gave it up. It's a good idea, but the technique required is such that a computer can't manage it yet. We're not far enough. So they then decided that two was the real answer, but they gave that up even quicker, two legs. You think of a 100-ton tank on two legs. You think of the thing coming, lumbering up to you on two legs, and with two television eyes up top here to see where it is. It's grotesque, isn't it? Now, let me put this question to you, just to show where we are. I once saw a ballet dancer, on the television screen, I believe it was, stand on one toe, just one toe, and whirl round in a pirouette for 2 or 3 minutes, and stop, didn't fall over, wasn't giddy or anything like that, didn't lose her balance, and then she turned around and whirled the other way round, on one toe. Now, ladies and gentlemen, engineers all, lend me your ears. Would you make a machine that could do that? How would you set about it? You think The human body, standing on two legs, is highly unstable. But standing on one toe, well, I mean, it's enough to make you crazy, isn't it? From an engineer's point of view. Now think, I'm going to hammer it home. The computer that will do that on one sperm, the size of a pin point, and one egg, the size of a pinhead, to do it. You think of that. It's incredible, isn't it? It's absolutely incredible. And then you think, you feed the babe on some milk, and you feed me on some potatoes and fish, and I'll translate it from any language you like that I happen to know. This will bring me to my last little story, and then I've finished for tonight. I was once in a Christian conference at Nyborg Strand in Denmark, and there were about 300 or 400 lovely Christian people there at this conference, and Paul Madsen was the leader there. And we had amongst these Christian people a Negro there. He was the blackest Negro I've ever seen. He was absolutely coal black, real coal black. And his eyes and his teeth were shining white. And when he smiled, well, you could almost hear the echo of it in the windows, you know, because he smiled so such a broad smile. So Paul Madsen said to me, "That man's a Christian. You can see it. His face shines." And it did. He said, "Would you try and get him to give his testimony?" So I said, "Sure." So I went up to him, and he was a huge fellow and a smiling face. It was an experience to go up to him. So I said to him, in German, "Would you like to give your testimony?" And he looked at me as I had shot him. So I held off. So I then said to him in Danish, well, Norwegian we spoke in those days, I said to him in Norwegian, "Would you like to give your testimony?" And he looked even more mystified. So I tried him in English, and that was even worse. He'd got no idea what I was getting at. So I thought it was no good. So then I thought, well, okay, maybe he comes from Africa, from the old French colonies there. So I tried him in French. We were living in Geneva at the time, you see. So I tried him in French, and his face, his lovely face, lit up as broad as you could like, you know, like a searchlight. So he said he sure would. So I went to Paul Madsen and said, "Look, it's no good. The people here don't speak French, and he only speaks pidgin French. It was a shocking French, like Cockney English, you know." So I said, "We can't do it." "Oh," he said, "we can, of course we can do it." He was a lawyer, was Paul Madsen, a nice Christian lawyer. He said, "Of course we can do it." Well, I said, "You do it then." "Oh, no," he said, I don't speak French." "But you do." So I said, "Okay, yes, yes, you needn't look at me like that, but what do you want me to do?" "Oh," he said, "it's perfectly simple. There are 300 or 400 Christian people here who want to hear a Christian testimony, and you're the key." I said, "You don't say." He said, "I do." Now, he said, "You go and talk to that man. He is a nice man. I met him recently again. He's a nice man." He said, "You go and talk to that man and get used to his pidgin French, and then you translate him into Norwegian. We all understand Norwegian here. You have lived in Bergen in Norway. Now come on, if you can do a seminar in Norwegian, you can do a French Norwegian seminar too." So I said, "Well, okay, if you'll pray for me, I will." So I got to this dear fellow and had half an hour's chat with him over his testimony, and it was an experience to talk to him about the Lord. And then I said, "Would you give your testimony to me in French?" So he said, "Well, we'll run through it first." So he ran through his testimony in French first, and we stood up before these 200 or 300 people out there, and you know, you could do it. I translated him sentence by sentence into Bokmål, which is the official language of the academics in Norway. Do you know, they were absolutely joyful over that testimony. It was marvellous. Now you think of trying to get a machine to do that. I'd never done it in my life before. I'm only seeing it because you've got the same type, the same model computer as I have. If you'd bothered to learn the coding for French and the coding for Norwegian, the brain, once you've got the codes in there, all the rest the brain will do. And that, on one sperm, the wiring, and on one egg, the wiring, and it can be done. Now it says in the Holy Scriptures, and with this I finish, ladies and gentlemen, tonight, it says in the Holy Scriptures, all things were made by him, Jesus, and for him. Now you think of the sheer logos intelligence of the Lord Jesus to have given away in such an abundant manner the amount of ability to do these things for him. You think of the joy it must give him when he sees that the work the Logos has put into us is being put to useful purposes. You think of the things you've done today with the machinery he's given you, his super intelligence to do that. You think of the sheer joy of looking at the miniaturization on one sperm and one egg, and then the development of that with a few mineral salts, a few proteins, and a few carbohydrates, and it all grows up to you. You didn't make yourself grow like you are. Your parents saw to it that you got enough to eat and all the rest of it, and then all the rest of it grows out of that work that the Lord Jesus put into our genes, into our DNA molecule. Now the last thought is this, and it's an important one, if I might say so. It's this. You think of the Lord Jesus as the omniscient one. He knows everything. As the super intelligent one, knowing everything. You think of him as the super omnipotent one, the all-powerful one. He could have had the 12 legions of angels save him from the scandal of the cross. And he said, no. How then should the scriptures be fulfilled and the world be redeemed if I don't set my face as a flint to go to Jerusalem and die? You think of the intelligent one. He was a real academic, wasn't he? If he could do all these things and knew all these things. And you think he chose to offer himself as a sacrifice for you, so that you can choose to offer yourself as a sacrifice for him. And that's our sensible, reasonable service of God. Keep that in mind. Jesus was not the poor, humble carpenter who knew little and didn't know where he was going, but the one who set his face as a flint to offer himself on that altar to make us useful for himself. Think of it. Now, if you want to look at the chemistry of these things, ladies and gentlemen, I've finished that now. If you want to look at the chemistry and the information theory of these things I've been talking about, you can have a look at them in the books at the back. One of them called The Creation of Life, and there I go into the chemistry of how man was made. The other one is The Natural Sciences Know Nothing of Evolution, where I've shown how we digest food and how it's absolute bunkum and nonsense to say that we were made by random processes over millions of years. And the last one is The Scientific Alternative to Evolutionary Theory, where I've gone into the information theory to see these things and work them through. Think of them. You can offer yourselves, so can I, to him as the super intelligent one offered himself for us. We'll pray together. We ask thee, Lord Jesus, that we might learn to love thee as thou dost love us. Take away all the sin which dulls our faces and make us bright for thyself. Bless everyone here. Thou seest the various needs we all have. Help us to turn to thee to get the help in time of need we need every day. So bless us all. Bless the pastor and all who work here. Amen.